Hirsch Greenberg is the practicum coordinator and department head at the Department of Justice Studies at the University of Regina. Hirsch has worked and volunteered with people in justice, corrections, social services, and health and education sectors throughout his career. His vocations span working and volunteering for community-based organizations and Aboriginal communities. He has participated in innovative approaches to mental disorders and addictions, programs for sex trade workers, responses to child abuse, community integration of sex offenders, youth peacemaking circles, addressing homelessness, an alternative school for youth, and community schools initiatives. Hirsch has worked to promote restorative justice approaches to crime and community development, and has been a lecturer for the Saskatchewan Police College. Hirsch has published Responses Addressing Crime. He was invited to write a chapter on Aboriginal youth crime and has participated extensively in developing interprofessional collaborative initiatives and curriculum. Hirsch co-authored an undergraduate curriculum for the First Nations University of Canada for the Bachelor of Holistic Healing and Health in Mental Disorders and Addictions. He currently teaches at the U of R in the Department of Justice Studies. Last but definitely not least, Hirsch is a founding member of the Saskatchewan Justice Institute. We're pleased to have you here this morning, Hirsch.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm honored by the invitation. I noted in the agenda that I was to speak about the practicum that our students do in human justice, but I'm going to take a slightly different approach and present to you what I try to talk to my students about, and that's the idea of identity and creating a justice identity as they go through university and later on in life as they become professionals, and how powerful identity can actually be if we accept that it's our obligation, I think, as citizens in Canada and citizens of our planet, to put ourselves forward in the most enlightened way that we possibly can, ask ourselves questions, challenge injustice. So I start my story around identity with a conversation that happened many years ago around a kitchen table in Montreal with my father and his brother, my uncle. My uncle was a police officer in Montreal. And inevitably, the conversation always turned to the business of crime and the role that he played. Now, my uncle was a fairly famous police officer in Montreal, largely because he was unique. His identity was that of an immigrant coming from Russia in the early part of the 1900s. And he was one of the first English-speaking police officers in Quebec. And coupled with that, he was also Jewish. And in the early 70s, when he retired, Mordechai Richler asked him about his experiences. And one of the experiences he talked about was when Mordechai Richler asked him about the difference between policing in his time and today. And he said, well, in the 20s, there was only one police car in Montreal. So inevitably, Richler said, well, how did you transport criminals? He said, well, we put as many as we could in the car, and those that we couldn't fit in the car, we tied to the roof like a deer. And if you knew my uncle, you knew that was the truth. Right? Well, then he asked him about interrogation techniques. He said, well, we would interrogate them and try to, you know, gain a confession from them. And he said, well, what if you couldn't gain a confession? He said, well, we would take them downstairs and explain the law. Right? We've come a ways since the 1920s, right? In many respects, and in some respects we haven't, right? Our identity of justice, I'm very concerned about today in Canada, right? And as Andrew mentioned, and thank you for the introduction, I'm a really big fan of restorative justice. I think that it is really important that when harm is done, that we actually address it between the individuals and groups that have actually been harmed, right? I see offenders and victims in the same light. I see them both as victims. In my career, I have yet to see an offender who has either himself or herself not been traumatized in some way, right? And that they are more than just being a thief. And a person who lies is more than just being a liar. Even a person who kills is more than just being a killer. I think it's really important that we are able to see the suffering of people. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who you may know, Lutheran minister in the 30s who opposed Nazi Germany's rise, talked about that we need to look at people not so much in how they behave, and in what they say, but we really need to understand people in what they suffer. And if we could understand that suffering, we can better able our interventions in what we do. I'm not exactly sure why the Western world is so captivated, right, by the idea of incarceration as a solution to human problems. Right? The idea of punishment seems to me to be an extension of the problem rather than a solution to it. So I think identity and how we see ourselves as a country, as a province, as a community, as families, even within your fellowship, I think that identity, if we add compassion to it, can be very powerful. Right? And so I saw a video by Brian Stevenson, who's a human rights activist in Alabama, and he talks about this idea of identity and how powerful it could possibly be. And one of the things that happened with me as a youth around the kitchen table with my uncle and my father came up with an interesting idea. He said to me, you know, if you ever committed a crime and if you ever got caught and had to be sentenced to jail, I'd have to go and live outside the jail. I'd have to pitch a tent and stay there till you got out. And it struck me that he didn't tell me not to commit crimes. He actually told me how it would affect him. And that has stayed with me for a really long time. And so over the course of my career in life, I've really tried to look at why are injustices occurring, and try to instill in my students the idea that if we can build relationships with one another, and my students are really tired of hearing this, but I really emphasize the idea of relationships, of really getting to know the other person, and that's part of the theme I heard in what was presented to you today. There's a woman in Calgary, Margot Van Slootman, I think, if I pronounced her name correctly. When she was 12 years old, her father was murdered in Toronto. And she talks about this idea of sabona. Sabona is a South African term, which means I can see you. I can see inside of you. I can know who you are. And she promotes this idea as a way of healing the harm and repairing the relationship with the very man that murdered her father, Glenn Flett, who she now tours with and talks about the incident and how it affected her. She created an identity for herself that she now writes about in poetry and has gained a master's thesis, I think from the University of Calgary, along the idea of restorative justice and how powerful this identity has been for her and seeing her through the tragedy that took her father away when she was just a young child and how she's been able to move through life with this idea of identity. I'm concerned in our country that we have allowed the creation of the systemization of incarcerating people who are disadvantaged. If we look around just in our province, there is a highly disproportionate number of people who are in jail based on race, Aboriginal people. Upwards of 80% in our provincial correctional institutions and highly disproportionate in our federal institutions. We also have a very high disproportionate number of people in our jails with mental disorders. Right. We seem to think that if we can create this system to capture all these people who don't behave in accordance with what we think is normal, then the thing to do with them is to jail them. And this is historical. We've done this. I remember in the 80s when AIDS first came on the scene and people were absolutely frightened of contacting AIDS. And I remember watching TV and how people were saying what we need to do is create these isolated pockets where we could move people to. Right? We did the same with people who had leprosy centuries ago. We did the same with people who had mental illness. We built special mental health institutions outside of our communities to place these people into. It seems to me that even more recently, we've now embraced that idea that by pushing people away and cutting them out from our communities, that somehow they're going to come back as healthier citizens. Which seems to me to be a contradiction in terms. That if we want people to be part of our community, that we need to take them into our community. Even the worst possible offenders that you could think of, and most people, right, I think would agree that some of the worst offenses that one could create is around sexual offenses, especially sexual offenses against children. And we've heard recently, if people have been watching the news, Tom Flanagan, who got up in front of a student audience at the University of Lethbridge last week and said that watching child porn was a victimless crime. I'm not sure what he was thinking or even if his brain was actually engaged, but it was definitely disconnected from his heart. It was an intellectual argument. It wasn't a compassionate argument. Right? And I don't think we can separate out our minds from our heart. Brené Brown, who is a shame, empathy, vulnerability expert in Houston, Texas, talks about this idea of courage. And courage, in its original meaning, meant to speak one's voice from the heart. Comes from the word cur. Anybody speaks French, you know the word cur means heart. I mean, it means something different today, but its original meaning had to do with speaking one's voice. And I think it's really important that we be able to speak in a courageous way about injustice in Canada. And to me, it's increasing. While our crime rate is decreasing, our response to it, to me, is becoming more dramatic. Right? It leaves people with the sense that crime is everywhere. And really, it's not. Okay? The proportion of crime that's random, that actually creates fear in people's lives, is very small. The vast majority of crimes are committed between a victim and offender who know each other. And the worse the crime, the more likely that is to be true. So crime isn't random. Right? I think, again, this idea of identity is really important in understanding how people come to terms with the idea of whether or not they're going to even commit a crime. I ran a youth group at Albert School a few years ago, and it was called a peacemaking circle versus a peacekeeping circle, that I tried to instill in these young people the idea of identity, that they had a responsibility to make peace, not just keep it. One day I was away from the group, and some colleagues and some students of mine ran the circle and took the kids into the gym and for an archery activity. And I wasn't there. And when I came back, my colleagues and students said, you know, the kids absolutely behaved terribly, right? They didn't listen. They were all over the place. You know, especially in archery, you have to be careful of the idea of safety and risk and so on. Anyway, so we sat down and we had a circle about this. And in the circle, we went around and my colleagues and my students talked about how their behavior affected them. And these young people, 10, 11 years old, 12 years old, reflected on what their behaviors were and apologized. It finally got to the young boy on my right, who said how disappointed he was in how the group behaved when I wasn't around, and that this isn't what we're learning. And he went on, in some ways, to lecture the group. And I was absolutely amazed that he was able to do this at this young age, 10, 11. And even more so, he wasn't even at the event where the problem occurred. And so I asked him, I said, you don't have to apologize. You weren't there. He says, yes, I do. I'm part of the group, whether I'm there or not. From a 10-year-old. Right? Which made me feel good that some of the messages were seeping through to a 10-year-old. So the idea of identity sort of has a reoccurring theme for me, is that people begin to see who they are and how they want to respond to injustice, right? Either as a collective or as an individual. There was this young boy at the same school, and I was walking down the hallway, and I noticed that he had grabbed another boy by the shoulders, and he was shaking him. And behind that boy was a stack of boxes, and his head was sort of whiplashing against the back of the box as he was shaking him, right? And I stopped and I said to him, I said, what are you doing? Oh, he said, nothing. Well, I said, you're doing something, right? He said, no, I'm not doing nothing. I didn't want to correct him and say, you really want to say anything, but it wasn't an English class, so I avoided that. And he said, no, I'm not doing nothing. And I asked the other boy, who was, you know, the one being victimized by this, I said, you know, what are you doing? He said, no, we're not doing nothing. We're just playing. And to me, this wasn't playing. This was violence, right? And I could do a whole lecture on the whole idea of bullying, right? Because I think we should just drop that word from the lexicon of what we're trying to achieve. Because bullying sort of gives permission as going through a stage of life. It really is violence, and we should call it for what it is. Saskatchewan has the highest rate of violence among all the provinces. Right. Fourth in Canada, if you include the territories. I mean, this is frightening. Right? Domestic violence, unfortunately, is quite high up. Anyway, so I said, okay, Mikey, I want to talk to you. The boy that was shaking the other boy. And we went into the kitchen and I said, what were you doing? He says, well, what do you want to hear? You know, this is an 11-year-old kid. He's already got, this is not the first white guy he's come across. Tell me what you want to hear and we'll make this go away. And I said, I want to hear what you were doing. And he said, I was just playing. And it struck me that that's what he actually believed. That was part of his identity, that he somehow was able to normalize violence, because to him it wasn't a problem, and neither it was to the young boy that was being victimized by this. I mean, he didn't necessarily like it, right? But they saw it as play, and I saw it as violence. And so much of crime in Canada we think of as alien. We think of somehow, you know, those criminals. We have to catch those criminals. Well, who are those criminals? Right? They're our relatives. They are. They're our fathers, our brothers and sisters and mothers and so on. Right? These aren't weeds as if they blow in on the wind and plant themselves in our gardens and create all kinds of chaos, right? We nurture crime. We allow crime in our communities to happen because we don't have an identity that says, I have a responsibility to prevent crime. Not only by not committing it, by embracing those, right, who have fallen off the path and who do commit harm. Phil Gattensby, an elder from the Yukon, talks about the broken fence story. And in this broken fence story, he relates the idea that there was a young man in his community, 16 years old, whose parents had died some years earlier and who he was now living with an uncle. And the uncle was essentially a drunk and never really paid much attention to this 16-year-old. And everybody knew in the community that this young man was committing all kinds of grief. Graffiti, he was breaking into houses, stealing people's stuff, you know, stealing cars. But nobody actually ever caught him. Nobody ever knew, really, according to Western criminological kinds of processes, right? Nobody could ever actually get the evidence against them. One day he had been walking by this house where this family had just built a brand new fence. It was this white picket fence. And he had kicked it in and broke a number of the pickets. And there was an old lady sitting by the window, as some old ladies do, watching the things go by, and saw him do this. Now they got him. They have an eyewitness. So the community's response, including that of the elder who was telling me the story, was they were going to get him now. They were going to show him that he needed to be responsible. And they were going to have a sentencing circle. And in the sentencing circle, they brought in the family whose fence was broken. They brought in the RCMP in case he wouldn't pay attention to the people in the circle, because he could always charge this young man. And they were looking for someone who would stand in support of this young man. And no one in the community would come forward. Finally, one of the other ladies in the community said, I'll speak with him. And so they went around the circle. And the family talked about how much this fence cost and what the damage to the fence would cost, and the time and effort it took to build the fence, and the harm that was done to them. People in the community spoke and said, you didn't affect me directly, but how do I know I'm not next? And so they had a sense of, you know, harm being spread. Got to the RCMP and said, you better listen to these folks, because if you don't listen, I'm going to charge you, and then you're going to have to go to youth detention. And it eventually got to the woman who agreed to stand with this young man. And she asked people in the community, she said, how many of you know this young man? And they raised their hands. And how many of you have actually seen this young man in the community walking by your house or at the store? And everyone raised their hand. And how many of you may have seen this young man walking by your house or in the community at a time when you were having supper or having popcorn and watching a movie and invited him in? And they all bowed their heads. And so for the elder, he began to understand that while this young man must be held accountable for his behavior, as citizens, we are all responsible. I was in Calgary on Thursday and Friday and yesterday, and visiting my son, and my daughter joined us. And we were walking down the street going for supper, and this guy stopped us and said, you know, looking for some change. So I dug into my pocket and gave him some change. And on the way back to the hotel, another guy stopped us looking for some change, and I gave him some change and so on. And I do this all the time. We were in Newfoundland, my wife and I, and some of our hosts were taking us down to the wharf to get some fish and chips. Yeah. And one of them was a nurse who worked with the street people. And there was this woman yelling, I need a plane ticket back to Vancouver. I'm stuck here. And she's just screaming. And she was off, I don't know, maybe 25 yards, and just yelling this message out to her, how she was stranded and needed money, plane ticket back. So I went up to her and I gave her a few dollars I had in my pocket. And as we were walking back, a few people in the group said, well, you know what she's going to do with that. And I said, yeah. He says, well, why did you give her the money? Because I said, I'm lucky it's not me. We were all that close, I think. You know, if it's not for family and friends and community, we're all that close from being that woman on the street or the guys that I met in Calgary. Right? So the idea of identity, of trying to understand people's suffering, is really an important thing to me. And what I try to impart to my students as we're talking about the issues that they experience in their practicums. And they're placed at the jail, and they're placed in parole and probation and in social justice agencies like the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry and so on. And they're really struggling with this whole idea of who they are and what they want to be as they grow and mature as young people, and what their justice identity is. And so one of the themes we adopted for our logo in the Department of Justice Studies and partnered with the Justice Students Association was the idea of pursuing justice. We may never entirely get there, but as long as we're always pursuing it, we'll always be making progress. I try to get them to see themselves as people who, even after they leave university, what you want to do at the end of the day is leave the planet better than when you came into it, in any small way that you can. Because if we all do that, the planet will be a better place. Right? So, for me, the idea of identity becomes very powerful because I try to understand the identity of people who are suffering. I try to understand, as much as sometimes it makes me a bit crazy, the identity of government wanting to punish and how they think that that's actually going to resolve something, and try to respond to it in reasonable ways. Unfortunately, what we have today is that the idea that if somebody could repeat something over and over again, and often enough, it becomes the truth, whether it's true or not. And that's what I find too many of our politicians engage in, the fabrication of ideas, right? And it doesn't matter if it's true, at least not in the political sense. And I think it really should matter. I think we should, as groups and as individuals, speak out when we hear things that aren't true. And it's repeated over and over again. Like the environmentalists are nothing but a bunch of left-wing crackpots, right? Trying to stop Canadians from progressing. And he repeats it over and over and over again, right? And some people buy it as the truth, right? Now, we're not as bad in this country as we are in some other countries. Like in the United States, for example, they just come up with stuff, right? Like a woman's body can automatically repel rape. Like you got to ask yourself, what is this guy's identity? What is he thinking about? Right? But it's not about women. It's about getting elected and trying to garner a corner that he can continue on being the politician that he is. And I think it's very unfortunate if we have to sell lies and half-truths to get ourselves elected. So this idea of identity becomes really, really important. And so I'll finish with this, and I understand that you may have some questions, and I'm more than happy to try and provide some kind of response. But in the closing speech on identity of Bryan Stevenson, he quoted, when I first looked it up, which sounded like Dr. Martin Luther King. And I looked that up, and King had paraphrased, actually, a minister from the mid-1800s. And I can't go into the paragraph from the mid-1800s because it's in Old English, and I can't, with a bunch of yees and thous, and I'm not really good at yees and thous. So, but I'll try and paraphrase it. It was also used by King in the march from Selma to Montgomery during the Civil Rights Movement. And he used this phrase while he was incarcerated. It was also used by Obama in his first inaugural address when he was first elected in 2008. And both Obama and King cut it short, but this is the essence of the quote, is that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it will always bend towards justice. But here's the thing. It'll only bend if you bend it. So I'll finish with that and entertain any questions.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ingrid.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. And there used to be John Howard Society. Is that still around?
It is.
And I'm just wondering, I don't know if people here know, if everybody knows about John Howard. But I don't know if we can do anything to help here as Unitarian Fellowship with bending the arc.
John Howard and Elizabeth Fry were two people who worked tirelessly with people who were incarcerated, and they argued and lobbied extensively in England, largely for humane living conditions within jails, and in fact tried to argue that people who were mentally ill and people who committed crime should actually be in separate institutions. There is a John Howard Society in a local one in Regina, Saskatoon, and Moose Jaw. And I believe there's an Elizabeth Fry in Saskatoon. And they are also both national organizations. And the John Howard Society nationally, out of Toronto, is very proactive in responding to many of the crime bills that are coming through. So there's opportunities if you wanted to join the society, to join locally, provincially, and nationally. Elizabeth Fry as well.
We have just a few minutes, and there are so many hands up. I saw Joanne and Jamie, so maybe we'll limit it to those two comments.
I'm sure we can continue downstairs. It's warmer down there anyway. I have a question. I don't know if this is a fair one. Who knows? Anyway, there are a number of organizations like Souls Harbor that are, I guess, religion-based in their approach.
Mm-hmm.
And Unitarians tend to kind of shy away from that because we don't think anybody should be sort of proselytized when we're helping them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious what you think of those kinds of organizations. They're doing very good work, mm-hmm. but they're putting their own sort of philosophy in there in some way or other.
Tough question. I am of a mixed mind about the whole idea of charity. That if charity actually worked, we shouldn't have any poverty. I remember when the food banks first started. It was just a temporary measure. Now it's an industry. So I'm sort of torn, but at the same time, When I see somebody on the street looking for a buck or two, I'll give them a buck or two. I don't know if I'm helping him or not, but at a sociological level, if I can be academic about it, if it was me, I would not rely on charity for help. That I think people have basic rights. There should be a basic minimum income that everybody in Canada should be able to have, and everybody should have the right to a house. Right? I don't think in this country, with the richness that we have, that there's any reason, right, that we cannot feed and house every citizen in Canada.
Just a quick comment. It seems to me that at the end of the day, our objective is a peaceful and just society. My assessment of our justice system is basically that we do a reasonable job at holding offenders accountable, but we do absolutely nothing to end up at what I would suggest is the goal. And if I might go just a little bit further, and when we talk about lies and misconceptions or lies, as we may want to call them, that the whole issue of deterrence, whether it be either specific or general deterrence, is something that is just a complete lie.
It is. There is sufficient data to demonstrate that that's so. I just heard on CBC this morning how the federal government silences its scientists and how they're not allowed to speak, which I think is extremely frightening in Canada, where the only person that has the right to an opinion is the Prime Minister. Even his own caucus is held silent. I'll finish with this story. It's somewhat depressing, but also with a light of hope. Brian Stevenson, who lectures internationally, was in Germany talking about capital punishment in the United States. And it'll speak to your point, I hope. And he was talking about how 1 in 9 people in the United States who are sentenced to death are eventually found innocent. And he makes this point, 1 in 9. If that was the airline industry and 1 in 9 planes crashed, there'd be an outcry. We would not tolerate that kind of statistic, right? Yet there is this silence, as he says, around injustice, right? And he tries to make the point, and I fully agree with him in the years that I've been working in human services, that people who are poor are not looking to be rich. People who are poor are looking for justice. And so he continued on with the idea of how capital punishment happens in the United States. And this woman in the audience, an academic and from Germany, stood up and said, it's unconscionable to think of the systematic grouping of people in prison to execute them. And he's commented, because the majority of people who are on death row are black. Because wealth, not culpability, seems to be the general determinants of whether or not one goes to jail or one gets the death penalty. And he said, in Germany, we did that. We systematically went about gathering people up based on a particular idea, them being Jewish, and executed them. And though we are not doing it as openly as we used to, right? Japanese internments, First Nations people in provincial jails, upwards of 80% when they're only 13% of the population, we have systematically created a system that is doing exactly the same thing, in my mind. Right? And to me, that's frightening, that we systematically go about doing creating a system that incarcerates the marginalized, the poor, the disenfranchised. Right? And there is this silence out there. And one law, for example, that was recently passed that would speak to that is the whole idea of mandatory minimum sentences, which theoretically takes away the judge's discretion to weigh out how this person has been negatively affected in their lives and looking at their suffering. And that's why you see the difference between somebody getting 6 months and 6 years for what is perceived in the press as the same crime. But it's not, because it's based on the lived experience of that particular individual, right? Versus a doesn't matter what the crime is. The Americans have tried this. Incarcerating people, they have the three-strike clause, if people are familiar with that. Even if you would get convicted of what we would call in Canada a summary offense, right? Stealing a Coke from the grocery store. If it was your third offense, you get life imprisonment for stealing a Coke. Right? And what the Americans are finding, not because they're being more compassionate, they're finding they can't afford it. It is too expensive. 140,000 people in California are exported from the states to other states to be incarcerated because they don't have the capacity anymore. And while crime is going down in Canada, we have double bunking of people in isolation. And when you talk to the ministry about it, they go, they have a rationalization for it. And they call it a rationale. And I call it a rationalization. So I think, you know, that the whole idea of isolating people and preventing their voices from being heard, whether they're people who commit crimes or not, is a tragedy of our modern time. And that we have to find the identity to say that we have to ensure that all voices are heard, whether we agree with them or not, but they have to be heard. Right? I'm getting a little bit political, but I might as well. Harper is very good at making change a small bit at a time so you don't notice it. But eventually, it's like boiling water. I don't know what the new system is, but it boils until it gets to 211.99 Fahrenheit. When it hits 212, it's no longer water, it's steam. And that's how he's doing it. All of a sudden, we're going to notice this qualitative change in our lives because we haven't paid attention to the small bits, right? Because everybody's relatively comfortable. The vast majority of people are relatively comfortable in our society. It's a problem. I've had 10 years of academic experience now, and so now when I answer a question, it's like really long. So thank you very much.